the halo of our galaxy is a smooth signal, and its amplitude is probably smaller than both extragalactic fluxes of gamma rays as well as galactic program from usual astrophysical sources. So the problem is to distinguish a signal that is very smooth and has small amplitude from other signals. And such signals with small amplitude and large scales contribute mostly to small L harmonics of spherical decomposition. And this is the place where we should look for this kind of signals and distinguish it from other sources. Okay? So first I'll actually illustrate this idea in the case of simple Fourier transform of some data in an interval, and then I'll show some results for the spherical decomposition of actual Fermi data. Okay, so just to summarize, there are quite a few sources of gamma rays. First of all, there are extragalactic sources, such as point sources. There's also believed to be some more or less isotropic flux, which may originate from star-forming galaxies, such as our own galaxy. Then there are galactic sources, again, point sources, and some diffuse emission. It's pion production, which stands for high-energy cosmic rays colliding with interstellar gas and producing some gamma rays, mostly from zero decay. Then there is inverse quantum scattering with Bremsstrahlung, maybe some exotic sources, such as some remaining cosmic rays from AGN activity that happened in our galaxy some time ago, maybe some dark matter. Okay, so to have a feeling what can we expect from different sources, let me just plot the diffuse emission. So on this plot, the blue line is the total flux above 5 degrees. I also mask the point sources, and this is what remains of the Fermi flux. I think it's 25 months of Fermi data. The units here are E squared times DFD, so it's E squared times energy density. Now, the next three fluxes is, I took some particular model for Galprop, in Galprop, and this will be pi zero production. This is synchrotron. Sorry, this is inverse quantum scattering, and this is Bremsstrahlung. This line here is what we would expect from 100 GeV dark matter in NFW halo annihilating into W plus W minus. So we see that the dark matter signal is at least one order of magnitude smaller than typical galactic diffuse emission sources, and it's almost two orders of magnitude smaller than the total diffuse flux of Fermi. So what we need is we need at least 1% sensitivity of our method to be able to, just based on the statistics on the kind of fluctuations, to be able to distinguish dark matter from other sources. But the main problem will actually be not statistical error, it will be more something like systematical error, because we don't really know the distribution of astrophysical sources in our galaxy. So even if we find some signal that looks like dark matter, it doesn't mean that this is really dark matter, because it could be some population of high energy electrons that produce inverse quantum photons. And as we see here, the relative contribution of inverse quantum scattering actually grows between 1 and 100 GeV compared to, let's say, pi zero production. This, yes.
So each and everything sums up nicely to fit Fermi then? And here the
not really. So here I don't include isotropic, the extragalactic background. And it was actually surprising. I think it's still some kind of anomaly that the isotropic extragalactic background seems to be too high compared to what was expected. But I think currently it is believed that galaxies, star-forming galaxies, or starburst galaxies can contribute up to half maybe of the total signal. So there is no kind of isotropic contribution here. Also, there is an issue of, there's a possible issue of misidentifying some diffuse gamma rays. And I think they even introduced a new class of events, class 4, which is like super clear events. Because I think some part of this kind of bending may be due to misidentification of cosmic rays. Anyways, the second point that I want, question?
The haze, at what amplitude is the haze?
It's a good question. I think I should postpone this question till later because I'll show some results and if you still have a question, maybe you can address that. I'll put the haze on this plot also later. Right, the second point I wanted to make here is that usually it's very difficult to find astrophysical templates that model very well the data. So what we will do in this analysis is we will use the energy bin from 1 to 2 GeV. So they're just data from 1 to 2 GeV to model the astrophysical flux at higher energies. And the main motivation is that for most of the contribution, no contribution that varies on the sky comes from pi zero production. And we assume that more or less the same contribution will be at higher energies because this is dominated by the distribution of the targets, and the distribution of the targets is the same at all energies, right? And also the inverse Compton, although it becomes more and more significant, the index is not that different, so it's an okay first order approximation. Okay. And if we find some signal, this may be actually due to some kind of contribution from inverse Compton, but maybe it's also dark matter. Okay. So just to quickly show the general idea, suppose we have an interval from 0 to 1, and we put 10,000 events on this interval at random position according to some distribution. The distribution that I have in this case, it's mostly isotropic plus a little Gaussian distribution added to that. And let's split the interval into 100 bins. And what I plot here is I plot the counts of events in every bin. So on average, we have 100 events, but they have some distribution. The question is, what is the contribution of the Gaussian source? And where is the source, right? In coordinate space, it doesn't look very simple to solve this problem. However, if we go to Fourier space, we just do the Fourier decomposition of the counts of events from the previous plot, we get that the absolute value of the Fourier coefficients look like this, right? So what I plot here, these are just the absolute values of these coefficients. The green line here is the expected Poisson noise. So the normalization is chosen such that the Poisson noise is a constant equal to 1. The red curve here is the input model. So we see that the first two Fourier coefficients have significant deviation from the Poisson noise. Okay. And we can even roughly guess what the total contribution from the Gaussian signal is just based on the normalization at this point. Okay. So just to get a rough idea what kind of source we have, we can simply take the inverse Fourier transform of the first two harmonics, and here is what we get. The inverse Fourier transform of the first two harmonics is the green line, the input model is the red line, and you see that the green line traces more or less okay. The green line traces reasonably well the red line. On the right, I plot the initial counts, which is this red dotted line, and the blue line is the initial counts minus the green line, minus the kind of rough model. We can do even better. We can even try to fit the, if we have some template in mind, we can fit the Fourier transform of this template to the Fourier transform of the data.
to get a better fit to the model. So in Fourier space, the fitting procedure will look like following. We find the Fourier transform of the data, the Fourier transform of the templates, then we determine the standard deviation that we expect for the Fourier coefficients. In this case, it will be some constant determined by the Poisson noise expectation. And then we find the maximum likelihood model just by taking the difference between the Fourier coefficients of the data and Fourier coefficients of the model that depend on some model parameters alpha. We divide by the standard deviation. We get the chi-squared, which we can minimize with respect to alpha to get our maximum likelihood model. The corresponding procedure in coordinate space would look like follows. We have some template that we parameterize. Let's say we think that the signal looks like a Gaussian, so we can take the position of the Gaussian and maybe the dispersion as our parameters. Then we parameterize the expected counts in every pixel that we have in this model, parameterized by alpha. And then we have to calculate the likelihood as a product over all pixels, where in every pixel we take the Poisson probability to find NP photons given XP expectation. Okay. So the procedure in coordinate space would be to take minus log likelihood and then minimize this minus log likelihood to find alpha. In fact, if we do this exercise for the data that I have, we get more or less the same results. So the input fraction was about 5%. We get both in Fourier and coordinate space 6%. The position was about 0.4, and here we also get quite close to the position. And the dispersion, the width of the Gaussian source was about 0.1. So here the dispersion is a little bit worse. But the main difference is that in the Fourier analysis, I used only four first Fourier modes, whereas in coordinate space, I used all 100 pixels. So if I were to use an advertisement from a detergent, why pay more if you get the same result?
Did that follow if you choose a chi-squared in the Fourier space, that it becomes a Poisson likelihood in the coordinate space? Or is that just because you have few number of events only, and so this is why you choose to minimize the Poisson likelihood? Are they following from each other, or is that because in principle you can choose a different likelihood function, right?
Here?
Yes.
You could, but the problem is that whether this different likelihood function will find the correct model. So this is guaranteed to work in this case, for example, right? When you have Poisson probabilities when you generate the distributions of photons. So if you generate the distributions of photons with Poisson probability, but then you use other likelihood function, your estimations can be biased, actually. So that's an interesting question.
So that's the problem with the Gaussian chi-squared, because the Poisson is not Gaussian, so the Fourier space analysis that you have is an approximation, it's not exact. Right?
That's right, but the thing with the Poisson analysis is that, first of all, it gives the correct result. So it's not biased.
But it's because you have many events.
You have many events. But I think the statement is even stronger than that. Even if you have a lot of events here, if you use simple, so suppose your counts and P are very large, 100. This is very close to Gaussian, right? But nevertheless, if you approximate this likelihood, log likelihood, with a similar chi squared, you get a biased result, no matter how many events you have. Mm-hmm. And the bias will be much, much larger than the error. It's actually
I understand that.
But, okay. So somehow this simple Gaussian likelihood seems to be non-biased in the case of Fourier space. Okay. So just to summarize the differences
in Fourier space, we have a linear fitting procedure, whereas in coordinate space, we actually have to have Poisson probabilities, and the likelihood function is highly nonlinear. Here we also the method is very robust to different pixel sizes, because when we need only a few small L harmonics, it doesn't really matter what the size of the pixels is, as far as the size is much smaller than the corresponding angular size. However, here the absolute likelihood depends on the pixel sizes, right? Just because there's different number of pixels, and it's very hard to compare different models defined for different pixel sizes. And as a consequence, all right, so one of the problems here is that if we have several templates defined with different resolution, we need to adjust every template to some overall resolution and then use this same pixelization for everything. Also, I'm not sure if it's too bad, but I somehow feel uncomfortable that the Poisson probability is undefined for negative expected values. So the problem here is that if we choose some template, it's a rigid, usually it's quite rigid structure, and if we try to fit in the region with many counts, we can run to negative values in a region where there are very few counts. So if it's just a little negative, I mean, who cares, the overall error in the flux is very small. However, the Poisson probability just fails completely in that case, right? There's no way to define Poisson probability for negative expectation, whereas small negative deviation here is not really a problem. Anyway, so these were the reasons that I came up with why the spherical harmonics may be better in some cases than coordinate space fitting, although eventually the fitting, as we saw before, may give the same result. Okay, let me go on to the dark matter annihilation and how we can use spherical harmonics for that. So the algorithm has the following main parts. First of all, we mask the galactic plane and point sources. Then we can choose some astrophysical templates. In this analysis, I'll use low energy beam as my astrophysical template plus some isotropic distribution. On top of that, we can add some extra sources such as dark matter and so on. Then we decompose both the templates and the data into spherical harmonics. We calculate the variance of these guys, and we define chi-squared as before using this simple Gaussian distribution. There's one important comment here, and I think I'll even use the black box. The comment is about the inference of the first point on third, fourth, and fifth. So if we mask some part of the sky, then on the remaining window on the sky, the spherical harmonics are not orthogonal. On some window, these are not necessarily delta L and delta M prime. So if we take the whole sphere, then we know that spherical functions are orthonormal there, right? Now, if it's not, if it's some window on the sphere, then the spherical functions are not orthonormal. And the first consequence is that different spherical harmonics become correlated with each other. So there is some kind of, if we have some random fluctuations, then these fluctuations will have different, will have correlated effect on different spherical harmonics, which means that the simple sigma squared that we have here should be substituted by a general covariance matrix. So in the analysis that we will have below, we use the general covariance matrix that takes into account the non-orthogonality of the spherical harmonics function. And the second comment, also related to this property, is that in fact, the definition of the spherical decomposition is not unambiguous in this case. So one way to define spherical harmonics coefficients is to integrate, as usual, gamma f gamma d gamma over the window. Okay. So this is the usual definition of spherical harmonics coefficients, and we can use that in our case as well. However, in if we were on the whole sphere, then these coefficients, they also have the following property. They minimize the difference integrator squared between the function and a partial decomposition of the spherical harmonics. Okay. So this is like the best approximation in this metric. Now, if we are on the whole sphere, then this coefficient is equal to this coefficient. So this coefficient gives the best, the minimal value for delta. If we are on the window on the sphere, then these two coefficients are not the same. And in fact, we can easily find how they are related if we differentiate this delta with respect to ALM to get the minimum. So if we differentiate dALM star, we get from this that YLM, YL prime prime d omega. Get that an integral of YLM times YLM prime times A L prime M prime, there is summation over L prime M prime, is equal to A L M. So if we think about this integral as some kind of metric G L M L prime M prime, then the relation between coefficients that minimize this difference and the coefficients defined by this formula is some kind of lowering and raising the indices operation. Okay. And in the following, I'll present some kind of inverse transforms, or I'll plot some some partial sums of this sort, and they will be defined with the upper indices. So they will be defined as the sums that minimize this difference. And I obtain them from the definition like this by multiplying with the inverse metric. It's just a side comment. Okay. So now we have all the technical details more or less over.
Fundamental reason why you would like you choose this as a definition of your ALM. It's just your it could be anything else, right?
No, this is just first of all it coincides with the definition when this is whole sphere.
Sure.
And second, well, yeah, it's just right. Easy to compute.
The top one is I mean, so are you suggesting that you have to calculate this GL, L prime, M prime, and then invert it to get...
Right, so guys? The functions that I will plot, F tilde of gamma, will have the form A, L prime, M prime, Y, M prime, of gamma, sum over L prime, M prime. And this ALM with upper indices are defined as inverse this times this. That's what I want to say. So the difference here is that this is the real Fourier transform of the data multiplied by the mask. Mm-hmm. However, the interpretation of this is the function that approximates best the data in the region that you know the data. So it approximates the data, it's the best approximation to the data in the window, and then it extrapolates the data somehow to the region of the mask. Okay, so before we do the actual spherical harmonics decomposition, let's just understand how many spherical modes do we want to keep, and in order to do that, let's plot the angular power spectrum So here I plot the angle of power spectrum for the spherical harmonic composition inside the window and the energies are between 1 and 300 GeV. So I take all the photons between 1 and 300 GeV. I do spherical harmonic decomposition. I plot the angle of power spectrum. So this is CL, this is L. And the blue curve is the total number of photons. So I just mask the galactic plane, but I keep the point sources. However, the red curve here is I mask the galactic plane and the point sources. So the difference between these two curves is the absence of point sources for the red curve. And you see that the effect of the point sources is actually to reduce kind of the noise level. In this case, if the point spread function were absolute, then the effect of the point sources would be just as a constant here. Yeah, the force of noise. And the part of the plot here is dominated by the large scale structure. So, in the presence of point sources, the large scale structure that has this angle of power spectrum gets kind of obscured by the contribution from point sources here. Okay, and this is the true Poisson level here, and the effect of the point spread function in the case of point sources is to reduce from this noise level to the level of the just usual Poisson noise at the scales much smaller than the point spread function. Okay, so in principle we can take L up to almost 100, right? Now in the analysis what we do, we take L up to 15, and the reason is that we don't want to take L too high so that the corresponding angular scales are smaller than the scale of the mask, the size of the mask, which is 5 degrees. Okay. Anyway, so this is what we do. As the template we use for the astrophysics, we use the mask Fermi data from 1 to 2 GeV. And what I plot here is photon counts in pixels. The pixel size is about 2 degrees. So here I mask a galactic plane and a bunch of point sources. This is dark matter template, NFW annihilation, and some units. So these are the templates that we use. And let's take a look at the data. Suppose, as an example, we take the data between 2 and 5 GeV. So these are, again, pixel counts for photons. Oh, sorry, it's photon counts in pixels. With these energies. And this is what happens if I do spherical harmonic decomposition up to L15, and then I plot this function. So you see that this function serves some kind of approximation to the data in the known pixels, and then it extrapolates to the region of the mask. Okay, so
what was the significance of the dark, of the red and blue regions?
So this plot is obtained by basically minimizing the difference between this sum and the function in the window. So we minimize this difference in the window, basically in all unmasked pixels, and then we just plot it. So it serves as some kind of extrapolation from the region where we hit it to the region where we have mask. If we use these coefficients, then this will be just the spherical harmonic decomposition of this mask data, so it will have a blue, kind of blue line here, right? So real spherical decomposition. Okay, now if I subtract or fit the low energy bin and isotropic distribution to this data, I get this residual. So I get some residual in the spherical harmonic space. I do the inverse transform and I this inverse transform. This is what I get.
So you've subtracted the constant, the uniform background, and low energy rate. Or is that right? Or low energy template, that's right.
So what I do here is I take the data in 2 to 5 GeV, I do spherical decomposition, I get some ALMs, which you call data. I also do spherical decomposition of 1 to 2 GeV and I use it as my astrophysics template. Also I do spherical decomposition of the isotropic distribution, right? So I combine the two templates to get the best fit to the data. I find the residual after I do the fit, and I inverse transform the residual. This is the result of the inverse transform of the residual.
So supposedly this could be dark matter annihilation or something, or exactly.
Right, so if I now add dark matter templates, so I, in the fitting procedure I have three templates, then I get this. So the interpretation of this is that, first of all, this region is mask, right? So the excess here is happening inside mask. So it's a little bit tricky how to interpret an excess that I find, which is originally inside mask. The interpretation is that this excess has some influence outside of the mask. So this is what happens when I extrapolate this excess outside of the mask in the inner region. Well, this is what the data says. I don't have any special way of picking the data. Anyway, so this is what I get for 2 to 5 GeV. If we look at 5 to 10, we get this for 2 templates, which is low energy beam plus isotropic. This is 3 templates. There is even some over subtraction here in the center. This is 10 to 20. 20 to 50, and 50 to 100. So in the 50 to 100, nothing really happens. If I add dark matter template, it doesn't help.
So at some point you have like alternation of blue spots and red spots in the center?
Right, so this is over subtraction.
So it sounds like a propagation of the signal from blue to blue.
I mean, the difference between these two plots is the presence of an extra dark matter template which has more or less only contribution in the center, right? And it happens that the best fit in this case is such that I actually need to over-subtract, which means that probably this is not the best template to use for this analysis. It also means that the coefficient that I find that fits the data the best for dark matter template, it's probably too high. So the real coefficient may be smaller. Now if we just plot the coefficients that I used for the templates, I hope it's possible to see. So the scale here is again the scale of flux times energy squared. This is energy. And these are the coefficients that I multiply my templates to get the best fit. Okay. So this is the total flux. These green points here are the coefficients that I multiply the low energy wind template. So in particular, for the first bin, this fits the data exactly because by definition, this is the data, right? And this thing is zero. And the next bin, we already had some contribution, both from isotropic distribution and from spherical distribution, which is NFW annihilation profile in this case. And then so on in other bins. And then in the last bin, there was almost no contribution from a spherical template, and this is almost zero again. This is on logarithmic scale. Help me plot the initial plots from the first plot that I had. So this is again the dark matter expected signal, and this would be the signal that we need to produce the plots that I showed before. This is actually much higher than the expected dark matter signal, almost another magnitude higher. But again, in the residual plots, there was a fair amount of oversubtraction, so we actually should expect a smaller signal than this one. One can also notice that the error class here actually very small, so in a sense the statistical error in this case is really not a problem. Most of the problem is actually in systematics, because we don't know what templates should we use for the distribution of astrophysical sources. Okay, there's one more game that we can play. Actually, there's infinitely many games, but there's one more game that I wanted to show. Is suppose we want to test the bubble hypothesis by Su, Slicer, and Finbinder. So this was the templates, the shape of the bubbles that Su et al. Found. And we can just repeat all the steps and we do spherical harmonics decomposition of this template, we add it to the collection of templates in the best in the fitting procedure, and this is the residuals that I get when I have low energy beam plus isotropic plus bubbles plus diamond. And this is the residual 2 to 5 GB. We see that in this case, we actually don't get any kind of oversubtraction. It looks much better. Okay. Okay, so this is the resulting coefficients that I was multiplying the bubbles template. So this plot I didn't show in terms of the residuals here only at bubbles without dark matter, and this is the scale, the flux scale that I need for the bubbles. It's actually quite similar to the dark matter contribution, although we probably need to shift a little bit the energy. Anyways, the structure is completely different. Now, if I add both dark matter and bubbles, then the cyan point here is the contribution from dark matter, and the magenta points is the contribution from the bubbles. We see that, in fact, the central contribution is even higher than the contribution from bubbles, but both of these contributions are significant in this analysis. Also, the scale, the absolute value of the contribution from a dark matter-like template, on the spherical template, gets down, so now it's much closer to the expected flux from dark matter annihilation. And this is what we could have anticipated, because in this case we don't see any oversubtraction, so the actual coefficients that we need to fit the model are smaller.
So it's a bit hard for me to understand the normalization of this, because I mean, so what you're doing, you have a coefficient times a template. You can always normalize template by an arbitrary factor, and that means the coefficient goes down by inverse of that arbitrary factor. So let's
use the same normalization. Suppose that we use the normalization for the template to be always, like, let's say total sum is 1.
So like the integral of the template so over the whole sky is 1, is that what you mean?
Right. Okay. So that if you multiply it by the flux, then you get units of flux. So you have to be careful about normalization, because you have to normalize it to some.
So is that the normalization that you use, that the integral over the sky is 1, or for the templates?
Well, I use normalization such that the integral over the sky of the template times the coefficient is this, it's flux.
No, but
density, energy density constants the energy square.
No, but of course, I mean, I can multiply by dimensionless numbers. That doesn't tell me what's the normalization of the template.
Right. Well, in practice, what I actually do, I use the photon counts in pixels as my data. Mm-hmm. And then I normalize such that the coefficients are expressed in terms of these units. So the actual normalization is such that I fit the photon counts, but as a result of this fit, I get the flux density per unit energy per unit angle per time.
Okay. So you're saying basically the total energy that comes out in bubbles is essentially that times 4 pi, or is that in the bubble? Yeah, that's right. Is that true? Should I just take that number and multiply by 4 pi and that's the total energy that comes out in bubble?
Right, so if you want to find total flux from bubbles into your detector per unit per second per centimeter squared per GeV times GeV squared, then you multiply this by, let's say, the area of your mask, the area of your window. Then you get the flux from the window. If you interpolate it from the window, yes, multiply by 4 pi.
Okay,
good, thanks. Okay. I'm actually almost done. Just to conclude, I think that spherical harmonics is a good tool to use for the study of large scale distributions. At least it's a non-trivial alternative to coordinate space fitting, and it uses the correct information. It uses only the small pulse harmonics that capture most of the information about large scale distributions. And that's where the possible dark matter annihilation contributes the most. Also, the fitting procedure is, in a sense, more transparent because the chi-squared is quadratic, and again, the data is separated into lower harmonics and higher harmonics, and lower harmonics carry all the information that we need. And as a result of this particular analysis, we find that adding an extra template, such as spherical templates corresponding to NFW dark matter annihilation, reduces the chi-squared significantly in this particular analysis where we use low energy as astrophysics. Also, if we add the bubbles, then both the bubbles and this central source are significant, and in fact, we get even better fits when we add both templates. Okay, thank you.
Did you put just for the fun of it, first power of an NFW density just to see if it's consistent with the decay, you know? And if it's tracing the density, maybe it's tracing variance as well. I don't know. I mean, I don't think you claim it's a discovery of dark matter, right?
Not yet. Well, the last plot actually can be used as a limit. So if we live in the presence of bubbles, then these points here would be somewhere around the upper limit on a possible spherical signal in the center of the galaxy. So that can be used as a limit on the cross section. That would be around factor of few above the thermal cross section. But yeah, I mean, I think they tried very several things, also the dark matter decay and all gives pretty nice plots.
So again,
it all gives pretty nice plots, I mean.
Okay. So
it's not too constrained, yeah.
Okay.
This analysis I probably wouldn't be able ever to tell if it's decaying or annihilating. Any kind of spherical signal is very nice.
Do you have any feel how far down compared to the background can you go and sort of claim that this is a dark matter discovery, say, suppose, you know, you have more data and so on? How far deep inside can you go?
Well, hopefully we can get to thermal results. But the main problem again is systematic. So these errors here are statistical errors. These are just Poisson fluctuations in the data, and these errors are smaller than the level of the signal. So getting more data will actually not help as much as getting a better understanding of distribution, I don't know, of the gas near the center of the galaxy, or distribution of high energy electrons or the stellar radiation.
So, two questions. First, is the noise, the photon noise for Fermi uniform over the sky?
In the exposure?
Yeah.
More or less uniform. Well, I mean, we use the exposure here. So.
But if it's not uniform, then you kind of have trouble using this formalism because...
The exposure is included in the model, so exposure is a part of the model. So what we do is, we have this template that predicts, let's say, flux conductance, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then we multiply the expected flux conductance by exposure. So this will be our model that predicts some photon counts in pixels, and then we fit this model to the observed photon counts in pixels, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, if you believe that the exposure was calculated correctly, then it's not really a problem.
Yeah, it's a bit more technical than that, but we can talk about that later. But my other question is, do you expect the template for astrophysical sources? I guess you said it's pyre and decay
inverse Compton, a little bit of Compton.
Do you expect that to remain the same as a function of energy, or? Or did it change as a function of energy?
It does change as a function of energy.
It does change. Okay, then there's a problem with this prescription because you assume it's the same template, right?
It's the same. I mean, if the template changes.
Yeah.
Well, for pion production, this is probably a fairly well approximation. And the reason is that the distribution of targets doesn't change with the energy. Right, then the distribution of protons, of high energy protons, of cosmic rays, it has some dependence on the energy, but since they don't cool down, the spatial distribution at different energies is also very similar. So for pion production, it's a good approximation. It's not a very good approximation for synchrotron because the electrons cool down, so the
mm-hmm.
template that you use for, let's say, 1 GeV gamma rays may not be a good template for 50 GeV because you need much higher electrons, and these electrons, since they're produced mostly in the galactic plane, they don't propagate this far. The template kind of shrinks close to the galactic plane.
So that's another problem with your method then, maybe?
It is a problem, yes.
Yeah. So basically what you're saying is that if I look at those plots, those lines there, the pion model has the same shape everywhere in the galaxy, but the ICS one has different
shapes. Yes, this line can have different shape. And
okay.
You may expect something that is closer to galactic plane at higher energies.
Mm-hmm.
So in particular, for example, if you imagine that there was some kind of huge emission of electrons a million years ago, then you could expect some kind of hardening of the spectrum closer to the galactic center because low energy electrons, they can propagate quite far, whereas high energy electrons, as they propagate to higher latitudes, they cool down. Maybe an effect like that could.
So it would be nice if you could think of a template that you can add that could model that.
There are a few ways. I mean, one of the ways actually is to add some kind of tracer for the pion production to your low energy beam. Then the difference would be the synchrotron, but again, it's not really good. Yeah, that's a problem. I mean, it's one of the biggest problems, I would say. You don't really know how to model the synchrotron. The inverse Compton conduction.
Any more questions? Well, then let's thank Tim Trigan.